Well, welcome, everybody. Thank you so much for coming to this. This is Writing Beyond Binaries, a Trans and Non-Binary Panel. How's everyone doing today?
Woo-hoo!
Great. Excellent. Thank you. We're so happy that you're here, and we're so happy to have this panel, because first and foremost, we're here today to celebrate non-binary and trans writing across genres. And we are doing that by just taking just a small sampling of very established, successful writers that just happen to be within the New England area. I am your moderator, Milo Todd. My pronouns are he, him. When I do intros, please just listen to everyone else's pronouns as we go through their bios, because inevitably you're going to want to declare your undying love for them on social media. But when you do that, make sure you do it right. Basic 101. So we're going to move right into introductions of the panelists so that they can actually have some time to talk today. I know we have seven. It's a big group. We only have an hour. But, you know, we just wanted to make a statement. So first up, we have Gabe Colnovoa. Gabe, if you want to do a little wave there. Excellent. Gabe is a Latinx non-binary trans man who writes speculative fiction featuring marginalized characters grappling with identity. While he isn't working on his next book, completing freelance editorial work, or buried under his to-be-read pile, you'll likely find him making hard eyes at the latest article of guy's clothes he wants to add to his wardrobe. Gabe is the author of the Beyond the Red trilogy, written under his former pseudonym Ava J, and runs a popular writing-focused YouTube channel, Bookish Pixie, which currently has over 25,000 subscribers. Wow. Next, we have Alex Myers. There's Alex. Alex is a teacher, speaker, writer, and advocate for trans rights. Since coming out as trans in 1995, he has worked with schools across the country, helping them create gender-inclusive policies, practices, and facilities. Alex's essays have appeared in The Guardian, Slate, Newsweek, Salon, and a variety of other journals. His historical fiction novel, Revolutionary, was published in 2014, and he has two more books forthcoming, Continental Divide, coming out this December, and Between Dreams for July 2020. Next is Lisa Bunker. Lisa's first book for young readers, Felix YZ, was published in 2017, and her second novel, Zenobia July, came out this past spring. Before setting up shop as a full-time author, she had a 30-year career in non-commercial broadcasting. She now lives in Exeter, New Hampshire, with her wife, who is also an author, and between them, they have three grown children. In 2018, Lisa was elected to represent her town in the New Hampshire House of Representatives.
Yes.
Yeah. When not writing, when not writing, she plays piano, practices yoga, plays chess, and studies languages. Cameron Awkward Rich, over there, is a Black trans writer and educator currently living in Northampton. His first collection of poetry, Sympathetic Little Monster, in 2016 was a finalist for a Lambda Literary Award. His second collection, Dispatch, was the winner of the 2018 Lexi Rudnitsky Editor's Choice Award and is coming out this December. Cam is a poetry editor for Muzzle Magazine and has received fellowships from Cave Canem, The Watering Hole, and Duke University's Gender, Sexuality, and Feminist Studies program. Cameron earned a PhD from Stanford University's program in Modern Thought and, wait for it, Modern Thought and Literature. There we go. Beautiful unveiling. And he is an assistant professor of Women, Gender, Sexuality Studies at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Next, we have Elle Nichols. There's Elle over there. Is an artist, illustrator, graphic designer, sign painter, educator, and sometimes blacksmith. Elle's work has appeared in The Village Voice, Guilt Taste, The Atlantic, The Zinester's Guide to New York City, Smith Magazine, The Nib, and the anthologies Queer and We're Still Here, amongst others. He is also the co-publisher of the award-nominated comics quarterly Leylines. His graphic novel, Phlox, was released September 2018 to critical acclaim and is his memoir of growing up queer/trans in the evangelical rural South. Mm. Drawing upon his MIT engineering experience, he frequently utilizes the language of science, math, and engineering as metaphor in his work. Next, we have Kay Yolande Barrett. Kay's right there. Kay is a poet, performer, and cultural strategist. They have been featured at the UN, the Lincoln Center, Symphony Space, Princeton University, Tucson Poetry Festival, New York Poetry Festival, Poetry Project, the Dodge Poetry Foundation, Hemispheric Institute, and the Brooklyn Museum, to name a few.
They gave me 2 to 3 sentences.
Yeah. They are a 2-time Pushcart Prize nominee and receive fellowships from Lambda Literary Review, Vona Voices, The Homeschool, Pink Door, and Macondo. They previously served as guest faculty for the Poetry Foundation and Crescendo Literary, as well as guest editor for Nat Brut. Their contributions are found in Academy of American Poets, The New York Times, Asian American Literary Review, The Margins, Foglifter, PBS NewsHour, Poets House, Friction, Vita Review, Nylon, Huffington Post, Them, and Bitch Magazine. Their first book, When the Chant Comes, was published in 2016. Their second collection, More Than Organs, will be published in spring 2020. Last but not least, of course, Alex Marzano-Lesnovich. They are the author of The Fact of a Body, A Murder and a Memoir, which received a 2018 Lambda Literary Award, the 2018 Chautauqua Prize, the 2019 El Grand Prix de Lectrice for Nonfiction, and the 2019 Prix France Inter GDD, it took French 9 years ago, a prize for 1 year of any genre in the world. It has been translated into 9 languages and was named Best of the Year on lists in the US, the UK, and Australia. Alex's other work appears in the New York Times, the New York Times Sunday Magazine, Harper's, and Oxford American, among many other publications, and has been recognized with fellowships from the National Endowment of the Arts, the Rona Jaffe Foundation, the Breadloaf Writers Conference, Yaddo, and McDowell, among other organizations. They have taught writing at Harvard, Cedar Crest College, and Grub Street. They now live in Portland, Maine, and are an assistant professor of creative nonfiction writing at Bowdoin College. As we like to say, they D's and gentle them's, please welcome our wonderful, wonderful panelists. So we're going to see how many questions we can get through today. It's going to be a contest. There are going to be bets. There's a pot later for it. But first up, what was your best experience during the journey of producing your work? Nothing good whatsoever.
Am I starting?
I go right at it.
Okay.
Well, now you spoke first. It's like when you catch eyes with the teacher.
Right, yes. Yeah. Okay, well, that's fine. So my coming out experience happened right in the middle of publication. So I was publishing a trilogy, which if we get to that question, I will talk about later. But I was really unsure of how that was going to go because I had already published one book under my pseudonym, had like a very feminine author photo, the whole nine yards. And I was like, well, cool, now what? And when I told my agent and my publisher and editor, they were all like super awesome about it. My agent immediately was like, okay, you know, so how do you want to go about this? Like, who do you want to tell first? How do you want to handle this? And like fully put it on me to decide when I wanted to talk about things, which was great. So like on the queer side of things, in terms of how I was nervous about like how this might turn out versus how it actually turned out, all the support I had was really fantastic and kind of like blew me away, both community-wise, but also on the publishing end of things, where I was able to really dictate like what I wanted to do and when. And so I really do mark that as like something that was a really wonderful experience for me publishing-wise, in addition to like all the cool stuff of like holding your book for the first time and seeing it in a bookstore, but also getting the opportunity to tell people who were supporting me and my career about who I was and getting such an awesome response was amazing.
I just did an event at a tiny village called Pechabou in rural France. They had petitioned the festival that had brought me over. I just went over for 2 weeks of events there, my fifth trip there this year. And that means that in January, my first trip there, I had the experience of constantly being told, well, before you come back, could you just pick? Mm-hmm. Right? Could you just pick which gender you are? And I'd be like, no, I did pick. let me explain how this works to you again and again. And they were lovely. They weren't trying to be hostile, right? They just had a language problem. How were they going to refer to me? So backtrack to then 2 weeks ago, I had just gotten to France for the latest series of events, and this village had me come out there. And what they wanted to talk about was the gender binary. 100 people showed up, and they were like, could you explain this? Now, my book is not about that. My book is about a murder. I'm working on a book called I'm working on a book that's called Both and Neither, Making Home in a Gendered World, that starts in France, but that's not what I was there for. And yet I have found that people are ready, people are willing, people are starting to have this conversation. Take France, a very binary country, where in January when I was there, a lot of times people wanted to talk about how horrible the Me Too movement was and how would people still have sex? And I'd be like, okay. And then now it's like this opening up that is happening because people are starting to share their stories. Non-binary, they talk about, they have a new pronoun, yell. No one under the age of 26 seems to know it, but they're starting to. And then I went and did an event at a college, a university in Albi that is spending a semester reading my book and talking about issues in it. And three of the kids came out as gay while I was there, and one of the kids came out as non-binary. I think this is spreading. And to me, the most beautiful experience has been watching awareness spread, has been watching people. We know that stories unlock something in our hearts, and we know that when we start to unlock something in our hearts like that, we're able to have more compassion for each other and able to talk about things that maybe once would have scared a lot of people, and now people are more willing to come forward. Lastly, I'll just say very quickly, to me, the best moment after all the sort of sometimes tussles I've had with the wonderful publishing team, but has been in a position of really trying to have to understand, they sent me the paperback cover for the French book, and I didn't understand why they were sending it for approval. They had already decided not to change the cover. And they sent me two, and I hadn't opened the images. I hadn't had time. And they were like, no, we need you to do this. And so I opened it. And they sent one with my previous name and one with the name I use now without comment. And they just said, which one do you want? And so that's going to be the first book published under the name Alex, which makes me happy.
I'll go. I wrote my first book, Felix Is, as an unpublished author, and I really didn't ever think I would get published. And so I just put all of my geekeries in it. It has a chess subplot. almost all of the characters are non-binary or outside the binaries of gender or sexuality in some way. Felix, the 13-year-old protagonist, is gay, although that's not the main point of the story. His mother is bisexual. He's got a genderqueer grandparent. And there's various other characters who show up throughout. I did that more or less as a lark. I wanted to see how many rainbow characters I could put in. and then I got a lucky break, and I started actually facing the possibility of getting this published. But I was terrified that I would get some publisher who would say, we love your story, we want to publish it, but could you make Felix straight? Could you make it hockey instead of chess? You know, they would sort of take all of the weird geeky stuff that I put in it, and I consider gender to be one of my geekeries, and sort of normalize it, so to speak, or mainstream it. And I was so happy that they did not ask me to change any of that. All the gendered character, all the gender stuff, all the sexuality stuff is still in there. The chess is still in there. It's fascinating what they did ask me to change. I was told by the industry that I had written a middle grade book. I didn't know that until they told me, but it was going to be marketed to the gatekeepers for 10 to 13 year olds. And so they let me keep all of that stuff, but I had to take out, for example, the word asshat.
Good word.
And I had to take out a scene where, or I had to change a scene where a character gives another character the finger. And I had to sort of tone down a fight in a school hallway where somebody gets, beat up pretty badly, and so I had to make that lighter. So all of that stuff needed to be lightened, but I want to give some credit to the mainstream American publishing industry. They let me keep all the rest of it. It's amazing.
So for me, probably the best experience I've had with publishing this my book is that the people who come up to me and tell me how much it meant to them. So I did my graphic novels about growing up queer, trans, in rural Louisiana, with like this very religious family community. And it was a very isolating experience, as you can probably imagine. Like the nearest city to where I grew up was like a 45-minute drive. And my town had like 3,000 people in it, so, here's me like being very confused about myself and everything. And it's just been really nice to have like people like email me or like send me a message on Twitter or something, and or like find me at like shows that I go to and come up and just tell me like how much it meant to them to read about something that would resonate with their own experience. it's really meant a lot to me.
Yeah, I'm just gonna say basically the same thing in different words. So my first book came out on like a very small press, and I mean in poetry, right, there are like the small presses that circulate in the national conversation, and then there are the small presses that don't. It's a small press game all the way down. So it's a book that I wasn't sure how much it would circulate, but I am always so sort of thankful for the moments when I like know that it has gotten into the hands of the right readers. A sort of recent example is that I was in Ohio, I guess maybe on Monday or Tuesday, sometime this week I was in Ohio, and there were these two sort of maybe like 18 or 19 year old trans people who came up to me, and one of them was like, in high school I had two books of poetry. One of them was the collected works of Audre Lorde, and one of them was you. And there was another one who was like, my partner and I like read your poems to each other over the phone. I don't know what to do with that kind of feedback, right? But like, it really was a book that I wrote sort of trying to talk in some way to my younger self, right? To like reassure my younger self that like I was a kind of person that existed. And so it's always just like gratifying, right? To know that even though I'm no longer 19, 19 year olds continue to exist. and they continue to need to be fed in that way.
Yeah, I think to piggyback on that, when I was researching, when I was in poetry, I was in slam poetry essentially, and then community theater. So I'm not an academic poet. So when I was shopping for publishers back in the day as a tiny trans person 4 or 5 years ago. And the other question of what were my roadblocks, I can share that. But the thing that I learned when I was on the road touring my book, I learned that there's always family and community and trans and non-binary people, that people will make space for your book in ways that they may not make space in, for me actually, in cis communities. And my work is super hybrid as far as content. I'm a political organizer by trade, so a lot of my work is political content. And, you know, it's like I'm a four-fer. Like, you can get a two-fer where you get two for one. I'm like trans, disabled, brown, kid of a migrant. That's like four or five. So legit, in my book, it's so great for someone to come up to me and be like, yeah, you know, when I Googled transgender Filipino or transgender disabled, like, there was nothing. And that's how I was when I was a little kid. I was like, oh, you're either white and trans in poetry, or Filipino and straight in poetry, or you're usually really able-bodied, right? Even in a disabled context as a writer. So it was so wonderful just to see face after face to be like, yeah, I've just never read a book that just honored my whole self. Right? Like, I've never been to something where, oh, you're talking about chronic pain and transness. How does that relate? That you're not separate. We're not compartmentalized as trans and non-binary people, that there's a plethora, right? And I think that's something that I knew inside my heart, like in my body mind, but to see that elaborate, and also to see, like, I want to say younger folks, also just being like, yeah, I'm doing this mixed media project with this poem, and then organizing with this POC community, and to see that there's a hybrid approach to literary, right? That whatever I think is canon is always going to be fucked up or messed up in a really beautiful way. And I think that trans and non-binary community and poetry for me really has shown me that. Hi, Mia.
I think for me, one of the nicest things has been with my first novel, Revolutionary. It's about Deborah Sampson Gannett, who was a real historical person, and bringing history into the conversation about gender, making it real, and emphasizing that we've always been here, we just haven't always been called transgender, has been really delightful to have those conversations and taking the conversation about trans identity into spaces where it has not been. So that's been awesome.
Right, thank you, everyone. Now, to get to the angry side, I feel like Gabe's really ready to talk about this. What challenges did you experience while bringing your work to market?
Well, I appreciate you making it clear I'm starting this time.
Yeah.
actually, this is kind of a good segue with what Kay was talking about, too. So I'll start with, I don't have a book published under my name. And though, as I mentioned before, my agent and everyone behind me were like very supportive about taking it at my own pace and deciding like when I wanted to tell people, how I wanted to handle it. It was also a difficult situation because I was around book two when I was like, hey, by the way, guys, I'm trans and I'm not really comfortable with these pronouns anymore. And I couldn't, I feel like if I had asked to change my pen name, they would have let me, but I also knew like strategically, I couldn't really do that in the middle of a trilogy because I couldn't have one book published under one name and like the following two books published under another name. That would be like a nightmare in terms of bookstores and everything else. So, and like my publisher is a smaller publisher, so I knew they wouldn't be able to like reprint the first book with my name or anything. So I had to make this like executive decision basically to keep almost everything the same except basically my pronouns and just leave it be, even though that was like increasingly uncomfortable for me. And that meant having to go to events. And I remember my very last event under my pseudonym, I showed up and I had people after person come up to me and going, you look different from your author photo. And I was like, yeah, no kidding. Funny you should mention. And it was just like those kind of uncomfortable situations that like I knew going in I was going to have to deal with it. But also the fact that like I had to deal with it was increasingly more difficult. And so now I'm trying to publish books under my name and I've finished that trilogy. So that's behind me and I love those books. But I'm also like really excited to get a book out there that feels true to me and under my name. And that has been so far very difficult. I've been on submission, you're technically not supposed to talk about this, by the way, for about a year now, almost, with a YA that I'm working on. And my protagonist is trans, Latinx, and chronically ill, like I am. And I don't want to make it sound like publishing hasn't been moving forward, because we have a lot of really great trans books that are coming out. Like, 2020 looks awesome for YA and trans authors, so I'm, like, super psyched about that. But it's also been really difficult to find people who feel that they can connect. And when publishing is as white and cis and het and able-bodied as it is, it can be really hard, even for people who are like well-meaning, to find that person who's gonna like take a chance and say like, yeah, this isn't necessarily like me, but like I can still work with this. And so that's been like the biggest roadblock for me, where I've talked to my agent about it, where basically the consensus is like, everyone seems really well-meaning, they just seem also like a little afraid to like pick up this book. And I'm like, great, but that doesn't help me at all, you know? Like, I appreciate the nice feedback, but I'd appreciate it more if someone took a risk and, like, actually let me get this story out there. So I know that this isn't, like, a unique story at all, and I hope that eventually I'll be able to get a book published under my name, but until then, that's definitely been a more difficult aspect of it.
Yeah, ditto, but in poetry, I guess. Yeah. I think as Cam had mentioned, that the small press really dominates the sphere for folks in poetry. As you start out, it's not a goal, at least when I started with my first book, When the Chant Comes, 4 years ago, to be like, I'm going to hit the big five. Like, that's like a joke. Like, what is that? Tapos, what I think was hard when I was shopping for my book was I heard the but. Wow, technique is really great here. This is wonderful. Can you just write about race? Can you just, I see that you have disabled content and we're really excited about that, but we don't know if it's a hot buzzword right now. I would always just be considered, and no shade or rudeness to that, but like a butch lesbian all the time. So it's constantly misgendered. So even people with the trans narrative or non-binary narrative, they have medicalized, medical industrial complex expectations of what that looks like. And I think, for me, I had to learn that my book wasn't essentially for poets, actually. Like, people who go to my readings are people who are disabled, who are isolated or chilling or organizing at home, first-generation migrant, Filipinx folks, you know, all the people in the four fur umbrella. I think there was a difficulty for publishers to have a reframe, to be like, oh, not, why are you, do you feel like you're isolating people with this book? Was a question I got. And I was like, wow, I really feel like I'm supporting lineages and poetry that's always existed and doing that fourfold, actually. Like, I'm not the first trans disabled poet. I'm just the most privileged right now in this landscape to get this position. So I think for me, it was very much a dissection. And I didn't want to make myself palatable. And so I made that choice for my first book not to go to a bigger press, to keep the poems I wanted in. And then also, my editors, though trans people can still be white supremacist and white, right? So in form or structure, you know, there would be a lot of backhandedness about something not being technical enough or craft enough, but funny, those are the poems that get me into the UN or get me into the Lincoln Center or into POC politicized spaces like Color Lines. So I think it's something to remember to really think about your heart and think about your inner editor circle, because that's what I had. I had poets, slam poets, theater folks, organizers, and copy editors look at my book way before I had it at Topside to make sure it was of my own integrity. And so that helped me move forward in self-advocacy, in knowing what I wanted from my book. Because I knew who my broader audience was, but I was being told, no, you just want this audience. And I was like, oh, that's too narrow. Like, we want to be cute, like all of it, give me all of it. And they're like, oh no. And I was like, well, that shortens my book by like 10, 15 pages, dog. So that's not gonna work for us. So I think that's the thing to move on with is, it's a very disability justice framework, is all, everything you bring, your whole body, your whole essence, should be in the book. But understand there will be systemic, industrial ramifications to that.
What everybody else has said. I'm gonna tell a story about a bit of movement, I think. So in 2013 is when I first started talking to editors about the book that became The Fact of a Body. And I still have one of the rejection notes that says, I could have handled it if you'd written a book about childhood sexual abuse. I could have handled it if you'd written a book about a pedophile murderer. But you put those two in the same book and then you put in that you're queer. Who do you think is going to read this? I could not find anyone to take the book on if I put in that I was queer. And I was like, well, it's a memoir. What exactly? What do you like me to do? Right? You guys. Then move forward 2 years. It never even came up during the process when the book sold. Yeah. Nobody pushed back. Nobody pushed back on international sales. We sold internationally at the same time that we sold it in the US. There was never even a peep about it. And then they used it to fucking market the book. No shit. Okay, so that's 2 years later. Now, with the project that I'm working on now, I have a piece, an excerpt from it coming out in Harper's called Body Language, How to Tell a Genderqueer Story, that'll be published in December. I will caveat this by saying that I have found the editorial team at Harper's lovely to work with. And my original editor left the magazine, as often happens when something's in progress for a while. And like 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, Milo was on the receiving end of a whole bunch of text messages about this. 2 or 3 weeks ago, 36 hours before the piece was supposed to go into production. So it had been through many edits. My editor had seen it many times. The new editor had seen it many times. I got back an edit in which they cut all the sex. I should say it was pitched. I pitched it as thinking about the way sex often gets taken out of the narrative of identity once it becomes publicized, right? So I pitched it as including a hell of a lot of sex, nonfiction sex, and as being about the erasure of trans identities, right? So I get back an edit 36 hours before it goes into production with no comment, in which they have removed all the sex and every reference to trans bodies, including my own.
Wow.
Just a total hatchet, no comment. And I was like, fuck. So we got on the phone, and the editor said, oh, you know, this didn't come from me, but this went around the office, and we all decided we're really worried about making people uncomfortable.
We exchanged words for a while.
We exchanged words. I had some words. There were feelings. There were words. I got on the phone and was like, wait a second, let me get this straight. By the end of the piece, it's about trans erasure, and you sent me back an edit in which you erased all the trans people. So anyway, I'm happy to say, like, sometimes you prevail. Mm-hmm. We fought. It's going to press exactly as I wrote it. Yeah. And fuck that. There's going to be a hell of a lot of sex in the pages of Harper's trans sex. So I think, look, I don't know what it's going to look like in 2 or 3 years. Yeah. But my guess is it's going to look really different. We've got, I just yesterday read a bound galley of Meredith Taliesin's book, The Fairest, which is coming out from Viking, which is like a trans coming of age narrative. And it also talks about her relationship to the idea of passing. Zane Jacatter's book, The 30 Names of Night, which is fucking gorgeous. Atria is going to publish it next summer. The protagonist is a Syrian trans man. And Zane, his handwriting is the one that scribbles out the character's dead name in every page of that book. So something, I have to believe that something is shifting, and it is not shifting fast enough. It is not shifting fast enough. But I do think that there's hope there, and that if we write the work and we just keep writing the work and just keep putting the work out there over and over again, people, I have to believe that people will move.
It's funny for me because, like, I'm coming from like the indie comic scene, which is very, very queer, very like big on like small press, self-publishing, zines. Like, you know, you get your stuff out and like you find your community. And like, I feel very lucky that like I self-published the first few chapters of my book, and then a publisher came to me and was like, "We love this. We want to have the book." And like, that was that. Like, no comment. It was done. So, like, but I mean, like you were saying, with the, like, every, like, the couple of years, even there, like, I've been, like, kind of in the indie comic scene for, I don't know, 15 years now. And, like, during that time, it's gotten, like, more queer, more diverse, like, so many different new, fresh voices that it's exciting to see. And like, I don't, like, I feel like I would, if I were just, like, a writer, not and having to deal with, like, other publishers, I would not have had the ease that I did with my book, or the support of, like, my publisher or the community I'm in. So I feel really lucky for that. But, like, so you asked about, like, difficulties making the book. Like, on a more practical level, like, halfway through making my book, like, comics take an inordinately long time to make. It's, like, hours per page, and I do all the writing and all the drawing and all the coloring. It's a long time for, like, my book is, like, 300-something pages, so it took me 6-7 years to make. And during that time, my wife and I had 2 small kids. And so, like, I, like, could not get any work done for like a couple of years. I would get like a page or two done and then be like, well, I guess I'm just gonna keep waiting on this. And like, but I discovered at that time that like how gendered spaces are with children, like as like a queer family with kids, and me often being the one who is taking care of the kids, like doing the primary caregiving. My wife works, like she's the one who works and a lot, and I'm more work at home. So like I'm with the kids, and like mothers will just not talk to me. Like if I go with the kids, it'll be like, oh, that's great that you're out with your children, like very like patronizing about like a masculine person watching children, which has actually led me to my next book of like I'm gonna talk about parenting as a trans dad and kind of like the lack of any sort of people to talk to about this, because I'm just like, where are the trans dads? Like, I found like 2. Luckily, I found 2 where I am. And just like, it's really made me question my like, what is masculinity? What does this mean to parents? Like all of this stuff has gotten dragged up, like from going through the process of like trying to write a book while having kids and like questioning my gender and like figuring out all this stuff. Yeah, that's probably the hardest part. It's just like, for me, like the amount of time it takes to do anything, plus like the amount of time it takes to also manage 2 small children and all of their needs. So it's a lot.
I'm gonna interrupt real quick just to say we've got about 3 minutes until we're gonna move on to the Q&A. So sorry to rush the rest of you.
Okay, I'll just say very quickly.
Sorry, Cam.
No, it's great. I don't like giving elaborated answers. I think that for me, it's been almost precisely the opposite. So again, like small presses, poetry, my editors have always only been white and cis. And I think that the thing is that because they think that they don't know what I'm doing, they just don't tell me anything. Like, people very rarely ask me to make edits or ask me about craft. Like, in interviews, people always want to know things about, like, my bio or things about what I think about politics, these sorts of things. But nobody ever wants to talk about, like, craft. And I think that this is a thing that happens to marginalized writers a lot, right, is that, like, it becomes assumed that the thing that we're doing is like a kind of, is always a kind of social justice or political work. And it is that, totally. But it is also craft, right? And I think that that's like a weird, that's like been a weird thing. It's not like a hard thing. It's fine, but I think it's a weird thing.
Two quick things. I have a sense of mission about getting trans narratives in front of all humans, and I have frustrations around that. One has to do with readers. It's interesting having a book out in the world and getting Goodreads reviews, getting reviews from random humans anonymously. Mm-hmm. And there's a thread in my Goodreads reviews where people basically say, too many LGBTQ characters. Pick one, somebody said. You could do a drinking game, said another. And I find that, I found that annoying and a little bit threatening, but also enlightening, because I realize one of the things I'm trying to do is to subvert the sort of dominant idea of what constitutes normal. And I'm trying to write books where there are so many rainbow characters that it's the cishet people who are fluttering around the edges and who are sort of out of place and sort of awkward. So that's one thing. And the other I was just mentioning to Alex before. I am a member of the Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators, and they have a conference, a regional conference every year in Springfield, NESCBWI, and I have been a teacher there for 3 years now. The first year, I got put on a panel that was a lunchtime panel, so the whole 700 children's book writers and illustrators were at this lunchtime panel. It was five people in the industry who are queer in some way, and we talked about representation. We talked about all the things we're talking about here today, and I got so much positive feedback from that. These people who said, I never knew any of that. Thank you for enlightening me. That was wonderful. Please educate us more. And so for the last 2 years, I've submitted ideas for workshops that have been accepted, and 15, 20 people have shown up. It wasn't a lunchtime panel. They weren't forced to attend. And 15 people showed up, and it's just like at book readings. They all had some connection to a person in our world. They had a trans child or a trans grandchild. And I so want to figure out ways to be talking about the things we're talking about here now today to the 90% who don't know anything about any of this yet. And I'm frustrated about getting that message to those people. So when you're trans, you have the experience over and over again of being the first trans person somebody has ever met. And that means we need to keep doing that work until it's rare. We need to be in a world where almost everybody knows at least one trans person, and we're not there yet.
And Alex, did you go?
I didn't, but I know it's probably time to.
Okay, if you got something, go for it.
It's going to be the same as everyone else.
Okay, great end to this. Well, thank you. We've got some time, do we? Yes, we do. We have some time for Q&A if anyone has questions. Absolutely nobody has questions. I see a couple all the way in the back there. Yeah, you all the way back, yeah. Yes, anyone that didn't hear, the question is how to distance yourself from your work and kind of be mindful and taking care of yourself with all that. Great, thank you.
I'll take a stab at that. So when I sit down to write, I say to myself very clearly who I'm writing for at the moment. And there's times when I say I'm writing for myself and I'm going to feed it to the shredder at the end, as it were. It's not going to go anywhere except right back into me. And that can be really nourishing. But there's also times when I say I'm writing this for somebody else, and maybe I'm writing it for, you know, my grandmother who disowned me, and this is going to be the piece. That's the audience I have in mind. And there's times when I get an editorial letter, like I just got, 24 pages single spaced. I'm like, why did you buy it? Editor's great. I have to take a deep breath and say, I'm going to be doing this writing for a different purpose. It's not for myself anymore. And I'm good with that. I'm totally fine with that. But keeping that audience in mind is super important for me to have a healthy writing practice.
For myself, I think I learned in other ways in that. So for example, when I tour my book and I go into a new city, I have a care team. It's just the way I operate in my body and in my mind. I have three people I get to check in with. Same thing as during editorial processes, right? Somebody I can just vent to and be like, what the bleep? What do you mean they're struggling? Bleep. No, I love this poem. I'm fighting for it. You know, like, they don't know what they're talking about. And then other people who can lovingly challenge me and be like, all right, is that really economy of the line there? Do you really think this is really serving your ancestors? Like, we set up as a group a set of questions of what I wanted my goals for my books to be. And also, like, knowing my body and how it works through chronic pain and whatever productivity is, right? When you're going into publishing, the timelines are tight and it's super ableist. They want you to produce a product in order to make money so that it sells to a larger market, even in poetry. So I had to be very clear and distinct in my contracts when I work with people, when I do a rate and rider, what that means. And also, I had to learn that level of accessibility and knowledge. And when I go to new cities, I make sure that there are one or two, three people with me who can help me advocate, who are working allies, right? And sometimes that's even as a trans person, getting my pronouns correct, pronouncing my name without people chopping it up, from knowing that I need food and water at a very particular time when I'm in too much chronic pain to get it myself. So there are very tactile needs that get me to the page. And also, honestly, just generally people to remind me that resting is also writing a book. Watching Netflix and laughing and figuring out comical points is also research. Being with your partner and being loving and caring, that builds your book. You're building the basis and baseline so that you can create something marvelous for your communities. And if you're not if you're not having access, intimacy with other people and with yourself about what you really need, your book's not going to be that great. You're not going to feel really great about it. So I want to make sure that before I'm coming to the page and after, there's a before, middle, and end. I have a ritual during, a ritual pre, a ritual during, and a ritual after so that it feels like I'm in a rhythm. And I have people to hold me to that and to remind me.
This is not going to be that different than what Alex said, but I think that it's also important for everybody to sort of remember that, like, if things go well, right, you will be able to write the next thing. Mm. And that sometimes it is important, right, to write the thing that produces the healing for you. It's important to write into and around spaces of trauma. And that is valuable, even if it doesn't ever see the light of day, right? And that, like, actually doing that work for yourself is going to be the thing that lets you write the thing that maybe then you can circulate around to the world, right? I think there's this, like, pressure, right, to publish, but sometimes you just have to write the thing that will let you write the thing that you actually want to show to the world, you know?
I feel that way about my first drafts too, where I often feel while I'm writing my first draft that it's terrible, but I need to keep the perspective that, like, I need to write this first draft so that I can do my best work, which is in revisions. I'm very much a writer that thrives when I'm revising, but I can't revise if there's nothing there to revise. Mm-hmm. So I find that keeping that perspective helps me not only get through that first draft where I'm like, this is terrible, I hate everything, like, I don't know why anyone would ever want to publish this, to the point where I'm, like, looking at my work and like, oh, okay, maybe this isn't that bad. I just need to fix A, B, C, D, E, and then I can start moving forward. And even when I'm in the midst of revisions and it starts to feel like this enormous mountain of work I need to do, I find that breaking it up and constantly reminding myself that what I'm doing right now is making the book better, and I'm bringing it closer to what I wanted to begin with, and it's evolving with me. And if I focus on that journey rather than the, oh my gosh, look at this enormous list of things I need to do, I start to have fun with it. And when I start to have fun with it, that's when the revisions really take off.
Anybody else?
I'll just second fun.
Fun.
It's so important to find, all this pressure starts getting on you after a while to produce, to come up with another idea that will sell, and you can't do your best work if you're not having fun. And it's about creating that safety and that space to get back to the geeky glee that was the start of the whole project in the first place. that joy of language. And if you can find that space and be safe in it, then you will do your best work.
The riskier the draft, the more getting the editorial letter sucks. Right? So I think that for me, a waiting period in between my feelings about the editorial letter and actually expecting myself to do any work is really important. What everyone has said about splitting audience and thinking about who this is intended for and how you're going to edit it, thinking in that way. Like I think I would imagine a lot of people, I even split physically the locations of where I'm doing writing that is just for me and is not intended to see the light of day, and where I'm doing writing that is intended to see day. But also, you know, something that I think is implicit in this space, but that maybe we should sort of name, community. Yeah. Right? The way you survive this is getting those letters, or getting the letters that are right, or getting the letters that are wrong, or just blundering on the page, or going out and doing events. I don't know about others on this panel, but like when I'm on book tour, I have to find some queer people in each city because otherwise I am going to drown. I'm not naturally someone, I'm very introverted despite being very social. So the event sort of does a number on me, and then I have to go like relax with people I can actually relax with. So for me, that's meant getting to know every little tiny secret hidden gay bar in these little towns in France, and they all have one, and most of them don't have a sign, and you have to just like knock and identify yourself, you know. But it's so just finding your people, yeah.
Awesome. Let's see, how are we doing? Yeah, we've got time for another question if people have. Yeah, you seem pretty eager over there. Question was between all the different genres, each speaking about their genre and how it works regarding writing beyond the binary. Thank you for bringing that all the way around. I appreciate it. You did my job for me today.
I do comics, like, and one of the reasons I was always drawn to it is that it's a medium that's kind of between fields. Like, it's visual, it's writing. So in itself, like, it's kind of across binaries. And I don't know, like, I've always appreciated how flexible that can be. Like, if I want to focus on the words, I can focus on the words. If I want to have no words, I can have no words. I can put in visual diagrams. Like, there's a wide range of what I can do. And so I think that, I mean, like I mentioned earlier, like, indie comics in particular is, like, very queer. There's a lot of trans people, especially in the past, like, 5 years. Like, really, it's probably the place I see the most trans people in one spot is when I go to like indie comic shows. And like, I somehow feel like the fact that it's like there's such a low cost of entry for production, like, you can just photocopy stuff, like, there's a big support for self publishing, it's not looked down upon. That like, there's a lot of voices that have gotten out, and I think it's because of like this medium that's kind of like across these different things, that has this history of like do it yourself, and that's really what's always drawn me to it, and it's kept me there. It's like it doesn't feel confining, and it doesn't feel quite so hierarchical in a lot of ways.
I'm so excited to see what you would say.
It's going to be a poetry standoff over here. We got two.
Oh,
poets.
It's not a standoff. I'm interested. I'm like, oh, what do other poets think? Tell us. No pressure at all.
Okay. I mean, some of this will be silly. But I think the thing about poetry, right, is that, one, it's not, there are fewer rules, you know? Like, nobody expects necessarily for there to be a narrative arc in a collection that begins with something like, even though my first book is very much a kind of, like, trans coming of age thing, right? It was like the kind of like obligatory book one writes when one like begins the process of taking hormones and like everything is weird. And poetry was like the place that helped me figure out that weirdness, right? But like nobody expects actually in a collection of poetry that there is a beginning and an end to the story, right? And I think that this is one of the sort of constraints of a lot of prose forms is that like people expect, right, that there is a beginning and end to the story, and you can subvert that form and all these things, but there's no, that expectation isn't there in poetry, right? I think that also the expectation that, like, the speaker of a poem is, like, a stable eye, right, is not there, right? The lyric eye, who knows what it is? We've been having fights about that for 100 years, hundreds of years, and so I think that there's, like, more space for me in poetry to sort of be... divided within myself, right? There's more space for the eye to change either over the course of a collection or within one poem, right? And this like it allows me to write in ways that feel sort of non-binary or trans. I mean, I think that this is really it, right? Is that like poetry, who knows what it is, right? And if the form or if the genre is like a bunch of mess, then you're allowed to like sort of play with that mess a little bit more. Yeah.
Yeah. One of my partners is a YA writer, and it always fascinates me because we come from two different planets, you know? And she was going to a poetry reading, and she's practiced this thing where she watches poets that she doesn't understand, but she goes, And I catch her. I was like, that's not what you're supposed to do it. And she's like, oh. And I think that's how my gender is, right? Like, it's like, that's an interesting turn, you know? And I think poetry allows for that. Like, you could, even though they're, I feel like trans poets, it's not that I know all of them, but I read Karen's work. Like, there's a small sect of us. And then if you're brown or black and just people are disabled, it's like, boop, 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 boop. So what allows me to play, and I think my disabled body and trans body and all those bodies, is in poetry, they're always like, let's talk about the body, you know, and in this, like, big, archaic, weighted thing. And I think with poetry, it's like, oh, if you want to shift your marginalia all the way to the right, do it. You want white space there, one word, period, boom, you know? And I think that's how gender is. Like, one page, I'm, like, very sparkly and femme-adjacent, and another page, it's just prose block. Navigate within that, right? And so I appreciate poetry. I also personally don't have the stamina for long form. Like, when people are like, yeah, I wrote 10,000 words today, I'm like, oh my God, Jesus. Friends, I'm on one poem, 2 hours, like, indent. Italics. Oh, look what that did. So for me, I feel like that's what my transness is. Sometimes I'm like, I'm wearing these shoes. Other days, it's like, nah, just chonies today on this Skype call. You know?
For me, in writing historical fiction, so my first novel is set in 1780. My third forthcoming novel is set in the 13th century. My second novel is set in 1992, which my students say is also ancient history. They argue with that. But mostly what I find that I'm doing is pushing against the grain. These are stories that have been told. They've been told a lot. They've been told by cisgender people. They've been told by straight people. I get to tell them as a queer person, and I get to put myself in those places. I get to put my brain in that time period. And I don't think I'm writing fantasy as much as I am rewriting history and putting the non-binary and putting the queerness into it. And that's really fun.
Related to that, I'm not at all sure that I'd be writing memoir if I had grown up seeing these narratives in existence and reading them. I went to school for fiction. My background and my training is in law. I have been working on a project at the International Criminal Tribunal in Cambodia for the last 8 years. I spent a lot of time there doing research. And yet I keep ending up writing these very narrative and very personal, and yes, very hybrid. They all have like elements of history, elements of research, elements of reporting. But they have personal threads, I think on a level, because I feel really alone in these narratives sometimes. And when I look at the bookshelves in a bookstore, I don't always see narratives that you know, make me feel seen and make me feel connected with other people. And I am fucking tired of that. So I think while that still exists, I seem to keep writing memoir, but I'm not at all certain that that's the genre I'd be writing in. if we had a world that looks a little more like the one I think we're all trying to make.
Along those lines, this isn't why I started writing YA or children's literature, but I have found that since coming out and getting the opportunity to finally writing stories that feel true to me, it feels very healing for me because I grew up in a very rigid childhood where I didn't have the opportunity to explore much of anything regarding my gender sexuality, let alone even question it. So it wasn't until my 20s that I got to actually have that space to start to explore myself and realize that, like, I could be happier than I was. And so writing children's lit for me and writing queer kids has been really liberating, where I get to write these kids who have these stories that, like, I wish I had. And they have these supportive families, and they have these adventures, and they get to be themselves, whether they are in some magical fantasy world or they're just in their regular hometown. And that has been so fun for me, just, like, on a baseline level, but also because I feel like I'm healing with them, where I get to say, I didn't get to have this opportunity as a kid, but you do, and I hope that this speaks to some other kid who also gets to have these opportunities and these adventures.
Totally second that. Yeah. Writing the books that I wish I had when I was a kid, an unexpressed trans child. I have benefited from the industry deciding that I'm a middle grade writer because there's not a lot of queer content in middle grade yet, and so I got to take advantage of that niche opportunity, as it were. I don't want to be known just as a queer or trans writer. I want to be out in the world of books and talk. We talked about craft before, Cameron mentioned. I think, you know, I'm proud of my writing on its own merits, not just as a trans writer, and I want it to be out in the world on its own merits. I am interested in writing other genres, and I find the industry wanted to pigeonhole me. I sold two books, and I had an agent at the time. I took my third idea to her, and she just didn't get it. And we went back and forth a bunch of times, and I finally parted ways with her because she couldn't see that I was trying to do something different. She wanted me to do the same thing over and over again. It's, I suppose, nice to have that problem, but it is still a problem. And I want to write different books each time. The one I have out on submission now is either going to end up as YA or adult, I suppose. And the one I'm planning next is definitely an adult novel. And so there's that genre hopping challenge that comes up.
Wonderful. Thank you, everyone. That is basically time. Nobody move. We have a couple of parting notes. But before that, please, just another round of applause for our panelists here today. Thank you. So three things, really quick. The first one, I realize I don't even know. I know there are books of theirs out there. What is the book signing situation?
If you would like to get a book signed or buy books, which would be even better, if you want to come out this way.
Okay.
Planning on going on to your next session if you
want to
exit through the back.
Okay. And are these folks staying right here for the signing, or do they go out that way?
If you want to come with me.
Okay, yeah. So part one, please let them exit first. clusters of queers are great, but not in this particular situation.
So. Oh, shit, friend. I'm so sorry.
It's okay.
That's what I would do.
We are ending on brand, people. I love it. Thank you. thank you. Two more really quick things. I feel like I speak for everyone here that if you have a question that you didn't get answered and you wanted to talk, I'm sure everyone would be welcome and happy to talk with you with or without buying a book and everything, especially if you're queer, or trans, or non-binary. And lastly, if you want more trans and non-binary goodness, Akawake Emezi, who is the award-winning author of Freshwater and Pet, is actually going to be the YA and speculative fiction keynote tomorrow at 3. So don't miss them because they're phenomenal. But thank you once again for coming, and we hope to see you again next year.